WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Alexander McAllister Rivera Jr., photojournalist, part of the first delegation of an African-American press corps to accompany a U.S. vice president overseas, friend of President Richard Nixon, influential with President Gerald Ford, inducted into the National Association of Black Journalists Hall of Fame. That last achievement may be perhaps why you've never heard of this distinguished photojournalist, reporter, and public relations expert. Glenn Harris, a history professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, first learned about Rivera in 1989. He started writing a book about him in earnest in 2019. By April of 2023, Lexington Books published Social Justice and Liberation Struggles, the photojournalistic and public relations career of Alexander McAllister Rivera Jr. Today, we'll learn about how Rivera influenced civil rights in the United States, what happened to his family after his grandfather fled Wilmington during its bloody 1898 coup d'etat, and why Professor Glenn Harris thought Rivera Jr. important enough to devote years of his own life to the study of him. Professor Harris, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you back with us.
Likewise.
And live, no less.
Yes.
In person. Why do you think that Alexander Rivera Jr. is relatively unstudied until now?
It's not difficult. We talk about where circles of people know him. If you're in North Carolina, you know about Alexander Rivera. You know about his life, his study, because of his prominence in the state, his prominence and his connection to North Carolina Central University. So there are stories. There were photo exhibits, both at the university, at the state level, of his work. And so people know of Alexander Rivera. I don't think anybody, hasn't been a historian that has taken the time to look into that. So there's stories about Rivera throughout his life, throughout his career, but no one put together all these pieces to say this. And so one of the most important things about the study is that it's introducing Rivera to the historical record. And the deficit is that no historian has taken the time to look at this and understand the significance of this individual. And so, but it's not just this, it's that recently there's been a lot of attention, or more attention turned into the importance of the black press, the importance of black photojournalists, and so this comes into play. And so there are a number of photojournalists and photographers that have biographies written of them, but no one's really turned their attention to Alexander Rivera. So his papers are sitting at North Carolina Central University and their archives. No one's really paid attention to him. Everybody at North Carolina Central knew about him. As I said, people in Durham without question knew about him. I've known about him since 1989. I did my master's thesis on him, and I just knew at that point when I finished my master's thesis and got my master's degree, at some point I would want to turn my attention back to him and say, yes, he deserves something much longer, much more structured, and much more well put together than my master's thesis.
It was eye-opening, to say the least, to learn about his influence on all of those elements that you mentioned, the black press and national news media in general. And and we'll talk about all of those elements. But I was particularly struck by the 1898 connection. So it was his grandfather who had to flee Wilmington because of the white supremacist cabal.
That's true. And it goes back further than that. It actually goes to his great-grandfather, who was born in Wilmington in 1836. And it goes back to his great-grandfather when we talk about all of these elements of that is 1898, because 2 years after the Civil War ended, his great-grandfather established a a consortium with other black leaders in Wilmington to come together to establish black education on the north side of Wilmington. We know on the south side, of course, there was already educational foundations in Wilmington. But for the black population on the north side, there was no black establishment or educational facilities for the kids on the north side.
So that was Thomas Rivera. His great-grandfather,
right. Yes.
And so this was called the Wilmington Colored Education Institute.
Yes, which is now the Peabody, which is the Peabody School right now. And it's at Campbell Square, exactly where St. Stephen's is concerned, where St. Stephen's is. So that whole square is important to the north side. It's critically important to the north side, that whole square, Campbell Square. But it's also centrally important to 1898 and what is involved there. But the Wilmington Colored Educational Institute is important because you're talking about 2 years after the Civil War, where black men come together in North Carolina to incorporate. And it's the first time that black men incorporated in the state of North Carolina. And understanding that the levels of racism, prejudice, discrimination that exist in North Carolina and exist in Wilmington, even though it is a large city at this time, to be able to do that and establish the Wilmington Colored Educational Institute for Education on the north side is incredibly important. And this is what starts the long line that will get us to Alexander Rivera Jr.
So just to get the full picture of the time that his great-grandfather was born into, the same man mm-hmm. who established, was it a corporation? Was that the structure to teach children of color, African-American kids? So that same man was born during the height of slavery.
Yes, he was.
When it was a crime to teach an African-American child or anyone, right, of African descent to read?
You are correct. And what they understood coming out of the Civil War, one of the major differences between whites and blacks is the level of education attainment, the ability to have that. So coming out of the Civil War, where it was understood you cannot teach blacks to read and write. During slavery and coming out of the Civil War, where that was the understanding that is the main difference. And so what is one of the driving aspects for blacks coming out of the Civil War is the attainment of education. Well, the foundation of that has to be providing that education for children of the black parents. And so that's how this comes about and why they want to do this. I understood what is missing on the north side of Wilmington. And having an educational institute, having any type of educational foundation is why they came together to put this in this corporation, incorporated to establish this.
And just jumping ahead a little bit, mm-hmm. many people who hear this discussion and know a little bit about 1898 know that Alexander Manly's Daily Record, which some people describe as the only daily black newspaper in the country at the time, that was burned down.
Yes.
By this white cabal.
Yes.
And Alexander Rivera Jr., who would come along later and do his work in the mid-20th century, he was named after Alex Manly?
Yes.
What's that story?
Okay, so when we talk about black leadership in Wilmington, we're not talking about a large number of blacks. We're talking about, especially during 1898, you're talking about maybe 32 black men that make up the leadership foundation in Wilmington. These aren't 32 men that are strangers. These are 32 men that know each other, that are friends, that are colleagues, that have conversations on a daily basis about advancing and progressing the black race in Wilmington. And so Alexander Manly, when he comes to Wilmington and is trying to establish himself into the Wilmington black community, becomes very aware of what is going on with the Riveras. They're one of the leaders in Wilmington, both his grandfather and his grandfather, Thomas Rivera Jr. They're one of the first morticians in Wilmington. And so having establishment, that type of self-business allows them to be part of the leadership class in Wilmington. So all of these individuals know one another. But Thomas Rivera Jr. and Alexander Manly once Manley gets here, have a number of conversations. Not only that, they both attend the same church. And so they know one another, become very good friends, very good colleagues. And Rivera Jr., Rivera Jr., understanding very much what Alexander Manley's trying to do in Wilmington when he establishes the Daily Record and what in the editorials that he's writing and establishes his foundation, that is his intellectual foundation, his educational foundation in Wilmington. They become very close friends, very close colleagues. He's very impressed with what Manley's doing, so much so when he has his first son, he names him after Alexander Manley. And there's communications that are available that I have in my files of how this is taking place and why he does this. And it's interesting because I understand that Alexander Manley is involved with the Wilmington, the Daily Record as a editor. Is the long line that's going to get us to Alexander Rivera Jr. and with the Pittsburgh Courier, with the Norfolk Journal and Guide, and with the Washington Tribune. So there's so many connections between what is going on between 1898. And when you bring this up, the most interesting part about this is what you want to see the length and the duration of 1898, what it comes to be. This biography lets you know the duration and the length of what 1898 becomes. But that connection between Thomas Rivera Jr. and Alexander Manley is real. It's there, it's authentic, and it gives you an indication of how close their friendship is.
Yeah, and so Alex Rivera Jr., who worked in the mid-20th century, went on to become this highly esteemed photojournalist and public relations expert, and we're going to talk about some elements of his coverage that are particularly notable that you go into in great detail in your book. You're listening to Coastline. UNCW history professor Glenn Harris is here with an in-depth look at photojournalist Alexander Rivera Jr.'s life. And when we come back from this short break, how a trip to Ghana, West Africa, changed his view of the world. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It was 1989 when his master's advisor told now professor Glenn Harris about Alexander Rivera Jr., the importance of his photojournalistic and public relations career and the impact that that career had on the movement towards social justice. More than three decades later, Professor Harris has a new book out, Social Justice and Liberation Struggles, The Photojournalistic and Public Relations Career of Alexander McAllister Rivera Jr. Now, in the first segment, Professor Harris, we were talking about the fact that Alexander Rivera Jr., named after Alex Manley of the Daily Record. Many people know that during the 1898 coup d'etat, the white cabal burned down the Daily Record so that that couldn't be used again. Ida B. Wells also saw her printing press burned down by a white mob. What's the significance of that?
It's as significant as the conversation you and I are having right now. It's as if somebody would step into the studio and just snatch my headphones off, snatch your headphones off, and crush the speakers, the microphones that we're talking into, to prevent the conversation that we're having. That takes us back to 1898. Said, no, as we have it, we need to leave the conversation there. What happens with Ida B. Wells is that Ida B. Wells is talking about how lynchings are taking place in the United States and what needs to be done, that the United States government really needs to address that. That is a threat, a direct threat to white Americans that are involved in this. And understanding the importance of lynching in the United States, the detrimental effect that it has, but the fear that it also establishes in the black community. And to prevent her from having that initiating that type of conversation, That is one of the primary reasons that you burn the print and press. Now, mind you, the print and press allows her to print newspapers that are used to disseminate arguments and conversations that take place in the community. If you can prevent that, you prevent conversations that are taking place. And so that's one of the primary reasons why we talk about this. And he's like, well, what takes place in 1898 when you have Alexander Manley's print and press that is burned also? You see a number of correlations, a number of considerations that are going on into both issues. Why you stop what Alexander Manley is doing, you want to prevent him from having any type of influence into the community and influencing them about what is taking place. You don't want that type of a conversation, those type of arguments disseminated. So you burn the print and press. Stopping conversation and stopping communication was the primary reason for that. And so that's why when you look at, you know, that often repeated picture that takes place where Alexander Manley's print and press was, where his office and print and press was, with the number of people that are standing in front of this and the burning of the buildings behind it. That picture is so resonant and so important to understand. It's not just the picture, it's the conversation that the picture actually induces, which is what is important there. And so there's a strong connection between what takes place between Ida B. Wells and what takes place with Alexander Manley, and it can't be overlooked. In the black community, I don't know many people in my circle that don't understand, that see Ida B. Wells and understand what happened in 1898. Not many of them drew the connection that I drew in my book. And so that's why it's important at this time and why it resonates with what is going on in 1898.
And we're going to get into some of the big civil rights stories that Alexander Rivera Jr. covered during his career. But first, I want to talk about the terms that we use. Mm-hmm. In the book, you primarily refer to African-American newspapers, African-American people. You use the term African-American.
Yes.
And in conversation, you and I have used the term black. What is the difference to you, and what's the significance of that difference?
For me, I look at black, African-American, colored, Negro. I look at these terms as synonymous with one another. In a general conversation, I look at this synonymous with one another. When I'm speaking about in academia, what I use professionally, I will always refer to African-American. And I refer to African-American because it resonates and connects with what the majority of blacks in the United States, where we connect to the continent of Africa, to the West Coast of Africa, and what is happening here. But there's a limit to that, because also in professional circles, I will use the term black. And I use the term black not only amongst in a professional sense, but also when I'm talking with my colleagues, when I'm talking with my friends. And it's one of the things that I'm known for in Wilmington. If you talk to my colleagues, you know, Glenn is always, he will tell you, and he will always refer you, he'll call you black man, he'll call you black woman. But I use that because in my research, when I was in graduate school, both from my master's degree and my PhD, it revolved around the 1960s. And in the 1960s, that is the term that was most common. There's a running conversation in black academia and black circle and black letters. What is the most preferred term to use for blacks in American society? Is it going to be African American? Is it going to be colored? Is it going to be black? And so it's an ongoing conversation. There's nothing set in stone says which one to use. It is almost a preference. And I can use them interchangeably. I can use them simultaneously in the same sentence. I can say African American, I can say black, but anybody black reading this almost by default understands what I'm doing with that. I explained this in my introduction of how I'm using these terms, and so it comes into play. But also, I'm using it like this in the book because Alexander Rivera Jr. dealt with these terms when he goes abroad and he travels into Africa and he's dealing with that. And that how he referred to himself, and I've talked to his son about this, that he always saw himself as black. And that was an issue with something that I had to understand, that he referred to himself as black, because I wasn't sure when I first started writing them. And this is somebody that I knew personally. I met him. I had a number of conversations with him. But being a young writer, a young scholar at that time, I was talking about in the 1890s when I'm having these conversations with him.
In the 1980s.
Excuse me, the 1980s.
You're not that old.
Thank you. Mix up of dates. But so when I'm doing my master's degree, I'm having these conversations with him. At North Carolina Central University, you know, I knew he was black, but I didn't know. And it's interesting because his last name is Rivera. And so his son tells me he always saw himself as black. And so when he goes to Africa, this is a different conversation and a different set of circumstances that he deals with, that he confronts once he gets into Africa. And so because he's dealing with that, I know I needed to deal with this in the book also.
One of his areas of coverage that I think won an award and got a lot of attention for the Pittsburgh Courier was a look at segregated schools, mm-hmm. especially in the South.
Yes.
Why was the way he covered that issue so groundbreaking?
Okay. And what we're talking about really is 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education. And what he does, what him and one of his colleague, Robert Radcliffe, what they do with the Pittsburgh Courier is they want to find out what the South, how they adjust to Brown versus the Board of Education. But the full background to that, well, the brief background to that is simply this. When the Supreme Court overruled Plessy versus Ferguson and said, okay, that for the most part, just for the sake of conversation, that segregation is illegal. When they did that, the major issue with that is not that they ruled it illegal, is that they didn't put any time frame on how are we going to adjust to this. And so what that allowed, you know, Southerners to do and Southern governors, Southern politicians, what it allowed them to do is to craft conversations, craft legislation that can circumvent what has taken place what's going to take place after 1954. Alexander Rivera Jr. recognized this, Robert Radcliffe recognized this, and also the publishers and the editors of the Pittsburgh Courier recognized this. Why this is important? Because the Pittsburgh Courier at this time is the largest black newspaper in the United States at this time. So they said, well, what needs to be done? And this takes place 3 months after Brown versus the Board of Education. We need to understand how the South is going to react to this. So they literally get together. They have a conversation with the editors. I'm talking about Robert Radcliffe and Alexander Rivera Jr. with the editors. Which states are we going to examine? And so they say we're going to examine southern states, and there are going to be – these are the southern states we're going to deal with. They're going to start with in Delaware. They're going to go from Delaware to Baltimore, from Baltimore to Washington, D.C., and then into the Deep South. And what they're trying to do is – and this is very interesting and very probing and important – is to what is the state of the Southern mind after 1898? It's not just an examination of segregation and what's going to happen. It's not just an examination of what's taking place in the Southern schools, but what is the mindset of Southern state legislatures, governors, and politicians where this is concerned? And so this examination, and there are other publications that speak that do this. And the best is a Journal of Negro Education that they give this very scholarly examination of what has taken place in the South. But there is no public, no black newspaper, no white, no mainstream paper or photojournalists and journalists that are doing what Radcliffe and Rivera do with this in the South speaks, examining this 18,000-mile trip, 9 states to examine what has taken place.
And can you just talk about the significance of the Pittsburgh Courier for a second? Because mm-hmm. when we hear that name, some of us might think it's a regional newspaper, mm-hmm. but you're saying this was an important newspaper that had some impressive circulation.
Yeah, and so when we talk about Pittsburgh Courier, we're talking about an example in the importance of the black press. It's where segregation is concerned, understand that the white press did not cover issues in black communities. They did not talk about that. They didn't allow black journalists to write for white newspapers. So the black press comes into play and plays an important role. We're beginning with this in 1830s when the black press comes into play. But by the time we get to the Pittsburgh Courier and when it's established, by the time that Rivera and Radcliffe are dealing with and Do the South Speak, the Pittsburgh Courier is the largest black newspaper in the United States. They have a circulation of close to 200,000. And so not only is it a – it's primarily established in Pittsburgh, but it has every region covered in the United States, and it has an international correspondence also. So it's not just a domestic newspaper, it's an international newspaper. 200,000 circulation is an impressive for a black newspaper and a black press that is read by the black community. Very rarely is it studied within the white press. But so when we talk about the Pittsburgh Courier, along with Amsterdam News and other black news, Chicago Defender, these are some of the major black news organizations. But it is the Pittsburgh Courier that is the largest black newspaper in the United States at this time with that wide circulation.
And I just going back to Briggs versus Elliott, which that was the South Carolina case.
Yes.
When they were seeking to force integration because it wasn't happening. Brown versus Board of Education had happened at the national level. The Supreme Court had ruled. But as you said, the ruling had no teeth.
Correct.
There was no time frame.
Correct.
There was people could say, all right, we'll figure it out. So Thurgood Marshall, who went on to become a member of the Supreme Court of the United States, at that point he was arguing that segregation and discrimination harms both those being discriminated against as well as the people doing the discriminating, the white discriminators. Can you just give us kind of a brief understanding of how you, first of all, how unique that particular angle was, why it was so important?
You're speaking about Briggs versus Elliott.
Yes.
Okay. Briggs versus Elliott. And I'll give you the back end first. The importance of Briggs versus Elliott, it is one of the five companion cases that makes up Brown versus the Board of Education. And so that in itself, and I understand Brown versus the Board of Education doesn't take place without Briggs versus Elliott. This is in Rivera's backyard. Rivera is a Southern correspondent for the Pittsburgh Courier. He covers Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. Those are his primary states. So what is taking place, what takes place in Clarendon County, South Carolina, comes into play. And I'll just give a quick anecdote. It comes into play where Thurgood Marshall is going to be the lead attorney here. That takes place because of what took place, you know, in during the same year at the University of North Carolina in their law school, when you had the integration of their law school by North Carolina Central students. So Alexander Rivera is covering that case also, but Thurgood Marshall is a part of that case. And so that's where really the friendship, well, part of the friendship with Thurgood Marshall comes into play. So when Thurgood Marshall goes to cover what is taking place in Clarendon, South Carolina, Rivera already has an established relationship and correspondence with Thurgood Marshall. So, and not only that, it's part of what he covers. So he goes to Clarendon County to cover this court case, and it's about the integration of the school system there. And so what has taken place is that the judges that are involved there, this takes, there's so many connections here. But not to digress in with the main part of your question. So when Rivera goes to cover Briggs versus Elliott, understanding that needs to be talked, that needs to be talked about, the seriousness that this case comes into play. At that particular time when it first started, he had no idea that this is what was going to take place. What he did have an idea of, because of his interaction with Thurgood Marshall, is how the NAACP would attack the segregation, the issue of segregation of the public school system at that particular time. And it was an important, I dare say, critical plan of attack of segregation at this particular time. Is what was needed, and that was like a chess move with what they're dealing with, what these attorneys are dealing with, and how they're going to attack this. Because from the inside conversations that he's having with Thurgood Marshall and the other attorneys that he's very privy to, he soon understood that what Briggs versus Elliott is designed to do is to take this case to the Supreme Court to challenge Plessy versus Ferguson, to challenge the ideal of segregation, the lack of necessity of segregation in the United States. And so this is where Briggs versus Elliott comes into play. It's one of the five companion cases that makes it Brown versus the Board of Education.
So one of the elements of the white campaign of Southern white leaders were saying that no one, including people who are African American, want integration. And it was a public relations campaign of sorts, I guess, to mm-hmm. argue, to get people to think that, you know, think about what it would do to a teacher who's right. African-American and that person's prospects for employment. And was there any part of that that was true, or did the African-American community as a whole recognize that integration needed to happen?
Well, it's not true, but what we have is, so we'll go back to the importance of newspapers and the ability to control information. For white politicians, governors, state politicians, school board members, which are all white, what they are able to do, because they have the platforms, that they can put this type of conversation, this type of argument out, and it carries weight with the white press, and say that blacks don't want to integrate, they do not want that, and they want their schools to stay separated. Well, these leaders that want to put this out, they just turn to the white press, make this argument. They have the foundation. They have the platforms to put this out. What Alexander Rivera understands and what the Pittsburgh Courier editors understand is that, no, we have a platform also, and we can counteract this particular argument. We have just as a wide circulation as you do. So one of the initial things that they do, I'm talking about the Pittsburgh Courier and Alexander Rivera, is they put out a survey of the teachers at this particular time. And the survey comes back, and although it's unscientific, it still gives an indication that what they are saying in the white press, that integration is not wanted and that segregation is the way that we should maintain society. What this survey revealed is that, no, not only do the parents not want this, also the school administrators and the teachers do not want this. And when I say what they do not want to maintain segregation. And so Alexander Rivera, along with the Pittsburgh Courier, as they come into Clarendon County, understand what is going on, and they are counteracting the primary conversation, the primary debate that is being monopolized by the white press and by the leaders in Clarendon County.
And you are listening to Coastline. UNCW history professor Glenn Harris is my guest today. After this short break, a look at how Alexander Rivera Jr.'s work changed African American newspapers and even the mainstream press. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Glenn Harris, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, has written a book about a photojournalist from North Carolina who influenced the civil rights struggle and became a member of the first African American press delegation on an official U.S. diplomatic trip overseas. The book, Social Justice and Liberation Struggles, the Photojournalistic and Public Relations Career of Alexander McAllister Rivera Jr. And Professor Harris, you talked about his coverage of the five foundational cases that led to Brown versus Board of Education at the level of the Supreme Court. And he covered Briggs versus Elliott, and then there was a second one at UNC Chapel Hill.
McKissick versus Carmichael.
Right.
And so that deals with the integration of Chapel Hill Law School.
And there was a strategy behind going after forcing integration of law schools.
Yes. And it was law school and professional schools, because what the NAACP figured out is that, and what the laws that certain states put into place is that, well, you can keep separate schools you can stop blacks from students from attending white institutions, professional schools, law schools, professional schools, you can prevent them, long as you have an institution that allows them to go other places. And so, and this is a separate but equal. And so, well, how do you attack separate but equal? And said, even if you have a separate institution where blacks can attend, they're not equal. And so that's what they understand very clearly. And they were determined to make this clear. Not only does this come into play where Chapel Hill is concerned, the integration of the law school at Chapel Hill, what comes, how North Carolina Central gets their law school is the foundation of when that is established in 1939, when that comes into play, the law school at Chapel at North Carolina, what would be North Carolina College at that time. Well, the professors that are at North Carolina College and the curriculum that is used at North Carolina College are the same professors that go to Chapel Hill. They're the same law professors, and for a while, it is the same dean. The dean at Chapel Hill is the dean of the North Carolina College Law School also. But there's nothing that is equal about these institutions. And so when there are Central students that want to attend law school at Chapel Hill, they're denied entrance there. And so this lawsuit is going to take place, and meaning that they're going to literally, the law students at North Carolina College are going to sue for admittance into the law school at Chapel Hill. And this starts the foundation of what is going to take us into Brown versus the Board of Education.
Now, we're jumping around a little bit chronologically because there's so much in this book. Highly recommend the book, by the way, Social Justice and Liberation Struggles, about Alexander McAllister Rivera Jr. Now, there was a moment when Rivera Jr. was in Charleston, South Carolina, and he was downtown looking at the old slave mart, and he found himself deeply emotional in that moment. Can you just kind of describe why, what was happening with him?
And I'll draw a parallel. Rivera's feeling the same thing in Charleston, in downtown Charleston, at their slave quarter, which is still there today. He's feeling the same way, or much the same way, as I feel when I go to the 1898 Memorial Park. When I'm in the Memorial Park, and it's called a park, but I take the park name off of that because it's a memorial. And so when I step into that ground, and mind you, I'm down there 3 or 4 times a week because I run downtown, I always stop at the memorial, but I just stand there because I feel the spirit of black people that are in that. And I'm just saying, look, it's a memorial, and that's a memorial to 1898 and all the lives that were lost, and I feel that. When Rivera is in Clarendon County covering that particular case, and he goes to downtown Charleston, because although the case is taking place and originates in Clarendon County, it's moved to Charleston. And so when he's in Charleston and he's at the slave quarters, that residual effect of what is happening to him, understanding that black people, black families, black children, black women, black men are put on display and sold, that it's a slave market, he has a very residual effect, a very emotional effect to how that plays with him. And understanding what he sees with those slave quarters is much how he sees the students, the parents, and the kids that are involved in that particular court case that originates in Clarendon County. And he draws a parallel between them. He says, you know, if not for 100 years later, these families that are involved in the Clarendon County case would have been those same people that are being sold at this slave mart. It's the same thing that I feel when I'm in 1890, when I'm at the Memorial Park, or when I go into Pine Forest Cemetery. I feel that effect, a very emotional effect. And I put emphasis on that, and I hope that is coming through. That is real for me, and that's nothing that is. I don't say that in a flippant way. I don't say this in just passing. That is very real. To know about 1898 and the duration of the time that we're speaking about, then to step into the Memorial Park, into the memorial, is real. And I draw a parallel that, you know, and by maybe osmosis, I understand what Rivera dealt with when he goes to Charleston, South Carolina, and he's at that slave quarters, and how that is going to have a real effect when he goes to Ghana. And so,
and that's amazing because Vice President Richard Nixon, he was VP at the time, in 1957, is launching this African Goodwill Tour, and this is the same time when Ghana is declaring independence from Great Britain.
Correct.
And shaking off British rule and becoming a self-determining government. Mm-hmm. So they go to Ghana first?
No, they go to Morocco first.
They go to Morocco mm-hmm. first.
They go to Morocco first. They come into Ghana. Now, Ghana is one of the centerpieces of why this trip is taking place. And so we're talking about the ending of colonialism, when one of the reasons why the United States is supporting Ghana's independence and the African independence movement at this time, and this is for selfish reasons, really, one of the reasons that they're supporting is because they want Britain to stop having so much control in Africa. And what that would allow the United States to do is to step in and allow other markets to open up for the goods and products that are produced in the United States. And so it's a very selfish reason in that regard, but they're still there to celebrate this. And of all the things that Revere is involved with, he's involved with the Marian Anderson case in 1939. He's involved with the last lynching trials in South Carolina and in Georgia. He's involved with what takes place with the integration of the UNC Law School. He's involved with, of course, the Clarendon County case. All of these things that he's involved with, the thing that really impressed him most and had the most effect on him was his trip to Ghana. And this is I just
have to say, in the book, on page 165 to 66, it's a powerful passage because he writes about that. He says there are all of these kind of milestones in terms of civil rights milestones and social justice and liberation milestones. And yet this moment, I mean, it's really moving.
It is. Watching the flag. The Union Jack of Britain lower and watching the Ghana flag go up on that flag post is very emotional for him. It's as emotional what is taking place when he's in South Carolina, when he's in Charleston, South Carolina. And why this is important to me is that because I knew Rivera, there are a couple of things that are worth saying here. Because I knew him, and this was a personal, very emotional writing for me. Just as a side note, when the book was finished, one of the first places I did when I got my copy is that I went to Pine Forest Cemetery because his great-grandfather's buried in Pine Forest Cemetery.
And Thomas Rivera.
Yeah, I go there and I walk up to his grave and I put my book on his gravestone and I said, I did your family correct. I did your family correct. I appreciate this. So when I said I would always go to Pine Forest Cemetery, we would go there. I would have conversations with him. And as weird as that may sound, that's very personal to me. That's very real to me. So coming out of that, understanding that that's personal, but knowing Rivera, I wanted to go every place that he went. So, of course, I went to Howard University. Of course, I went to Norfolk, Virginia, where he's working with the Norfolk Journal and Guide. I go to Washington, D.C., and so when I know, I said, I definitely have to go to Ghana. So I'm going to Ghana to follow his footsteps. But when I get to Ghana and I'm there and I'm where this takes place in Accra, it is such a beautiful country. It is an incredibly beautiful country. I also understand that one of the things that is affecting him, because you cannot go to Ghana, you cannot go to the Gold Coast, and although I didn't have this direct conversation with Rivera Jr., I cannot see him missing this opportunity. And the opportunity is where this connects to what has happened in Clarendon in Charleston, South Carolina, is that there are slave ports in Ghana. And these are the slave ports where the slaves are coming off the continent of Africa, put on their ships, and literally go across the Atlantic, primarily to, of course, to the Caribbean islands, primarily, of course, to South America, and then into the United States.
But, and you have pictures of some of these places in the book.
Yes, for this reason. So the Door of No Return is what I recognize that is the 1898 memorial, what I recognize that is taking place in Charleston, because the Door of No Return are where the Africans go through the last door on the continent before they're placed on boats that take them to the larger ships where they'll be enslaved. And so you cannot, when I'm at these slave ports, and it's interesting, when I was at these slave ports, and I wouldn't do the tour, but I would be there while people were touring, you know, one of the directors of the slave ports would come up to the slave council, well, do you want a picture in here? I said, don't take my picture in here. Do not take my picture in here. This is too emotional. No, I don't want a picture. I'll take pictures, but you cannot take my picture in here. And I did that because, not by happenstance, I did because that's how I felt. I said, no, this is not a place for me to be viewed in this. I would take pictures. So when I took a picture of the Door of No Return, to walk through that door is a feeling that I feel when I'm in 1898. It's a feeling when I go to Clarendon County, when I go to Charleston and I go downtown and I go into that market, because the market right now is just a example of capitalism and selling that run amok, that they don't pay attention to that. And so, because all these businesses there, and they're just selling knickknacks, and Rivera picked up on this, selling knickknacks and the latest wares of what takes place, what's taking place in Charleston. But you cannot come out of Ghana recognizing the importance of that. But also the people in Ghana, well, I say, as Rivera talks about this, how he deals with, you know, what it means to be black and what it means to be African American, is one of the same things that I was feeling when I stepped into where this incredible, incredible celebration took place at the stroke of midnight on March the 6th, where these flags are changing places, and how that is revered, that, you know, it's so emotional that he's crying at that particular point.
1957.
You know, yeah, I'm feeling the same thing when I'm there in 2022, and I'm feeling this in a very real sense. And so I'm happy because I'm in Rivera's footsteps. It is a lovely place to be in that it reconfigured how humanity should be. You know, and I could give a number of stories that would almost sidetrack us, because and they're important stories, or they're necessary stories, but they're not necessarily germane to, you know, when I'm talking about Alex, because the people there, what takes place there, when I'm telling them, you know, how it is to be black in the United States and some of the issues that I deal with, they're literally, why does this take place? Why are there so many murders that are taking place where blacks are concerned? Why are so many black people incarcerated in the United States? What is this black-on-black crime? Understanding that that is not the case when you're in Ghana.
And even in 1957, wasn't Russia calling out the U.S. for its hypocrisy on the human rights front? And that was, I mean, so Vice President Nixon is there celebrating the independence of Ghana.
Yes.
And Alexander Rivera Jr. is noticing, okay, well, and Nixon personally asked Rivera Jr. to be in that press delegation.
Yes.
That was a big deal.
Yes.
But Rivera Jr. is noticing, okay, well, it's great that this is being celebrated here and they're shaking off colonialism in this country. But what did it mean for him back when he thought about that up against the backdrop of his own country?
He's not unaware of everything that is taking place. He's writing on these issues. If you look at his articles that are coming out, that are printed in the Pittsburgh Courier and the unpublished papers that are available at North Carolina Central University in their archives, you see that he's dealing with these, you know, these imbalances of, you know, we're at a place in a country that is being celebrated for its independence and the appreciation of a black independence, but understand that in the United States, that is not the case. And this becomes even more glaring when we find out that, yes, that Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. is there also. And so this is the first time that Richard Nixon and King actually interact with one another to have ever so much of a brief conversation, but it is a very important aspect of this time, because while Nixon is in the United States, he doesn't visit any of the southern states where this level of racism is just appearing on a day-to-day basis. The suppression of black identity, of black life, is taking place in the United States. He's not visiting any of the southern states where this is taking place. Not unaware of that. He's very aware of that. Rivera's there. He covered lynching trials, so he understands these elements. So when we say, when I make the argument in the book that what is Rivera dealing with? He's dealing with this. It's not just what it means to be black and what it means to African American. It's like, wait a minute, how do I cover lynching trials in the United States with no support from the white government establishment? Then I go to Ghana with the vice president of the United States who's supporting African independence movement that is really initiated by Ghana. You understand these things that are taking place, and it comes in. It's just an incredible, incredible story that is worth telling.
It really is. And I'm sorry, but that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Glenn Harris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Rachel, thank you very much. I deeply appreciate this. This is lovely. It's fantastic.
The book, Social Justice and Liberation Struggles, The Photojournalistic and Public Relations Career of Alexander McAllister Rivera Jr. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. You can find the episode at whqr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.